let's see how far we can get with that. That we're starting to, hello. So let's take a step back for a moment and then reintroduce what we were at the beginning of last time. If we're going to talk about Jewish values in the business world, so our intent, this is an important point, our intent is certainly not to disparage any other system and to criticize for the morality or lack of morality of any other system. There are many fine moral people in the world outside of a Jewish context. But one point to highlight just as a matter of declared priorities. So part of classical economic theory that's associated with Adam Smith and the like is, and Adam Smith was very explicit about this, is that the marketplace takes care of itself. So that means a couple things. It means that just in terms of sustaining its own economic considerations, the marketplace takes care of itself, that the principles of supply and demand and everyone needing to serve their own self-interest will lead to there being enough for the market to provide and to sustain. But even just from a moral perspective, so Adam Smith wrote that we don't have to rely on the altruism of the merchants, that we don't have to assume that they will provide for public needs because they have very noble motives, but simply the nature of the marketplace is that everything will settle into place because you'll have to provide what people need in order to make a living, you'll have to find your niche in order to be able to profit and to support yourself. So therefore, even from a moral consideration, the marketplace essentially addresses its own considerations. That market forces, what's known as the invisible hand, meaning that things are being pushed into place because of the forces of how people just naturally interact with each other, that will take care of things. To whatever extent that's true, that's very well and good, but it's not where we're coming from as halachic and hashkafic Jews. The assumption is that we have values that are imposed onto the market, and that will be a large part of what we're addressing here, and that the Torah and the rabbinic literature has mandated certain requirements that are a part of our behavior regardless of whether or not market forces are going to ask for them. So we started by talking about a general concept last week. Last week we talked a lot about the role of interpersonal law and of mishpatim, of the principles that we can relate to and how it impacts on us, and we said some significant discussions about that. But then we started off talking about the very challenging concept of lefnim mishuras hadin, of the idea that we are meant to go above and beyond the basic requirements of the law. And this is something the Talmud tells us in at least two places, tells us in a number of places, but connects to Torah sources in at least two contexts. One is, as we mentioned, the pasuk in Veschanan, Veasisa HaYashar VaHatov, you shall do that which is right and that which is good. And the Ramban, commenting over there, as we mentioned last week, understands that to be a general directive that it seems on its surface to be both vague and redundant. What does it mean to be good, and why do I need to be told to be good if the whole Torah is aimed at that? And this was very much comparable to his statement of Kedoshim Tiyu, where we're told to be holy, that both statements are meant to address everything the Torah can't get into such detail about. That there are so many variables in life that theoretically you could have loopholes, you could find a way to follow all the rules of the Torah and still be neither holy nor good, and therefore we're told about both. We're told to be kedoshim and we're told to be good. And in that context, the Ramban invokes the idea that the Gemara does associate here as well, of lefnim mishuras hadin, that not only should we observe the law, but we should go beyond the letter of the law. And the other source is from this week's Parsha. And Parsha's Yisro. So we read that Yisro gives advice to Moshe that Moshe should not deal with all the disputes on his own. He should have a hierarchical court system. And he should teach people about the basics of life. He should tell them what kind of people to be in the broad sense. And that instruction, he says, "Vodaitim es haderech yelchu bo v'asamaisa asher yasun." He should tell the people the path that they should walk on. And v'amaisa asher yasun, that which, those actions which they should do. So the Gemara says in two places that hamaisa, that refers to that which we actually should do, the din. That's which we start from. And asher yasun, that which in practice we should actually perform, that is lifnim meshuras hadin, that is to go above and beyond. So we try to start off the topic a little bit. What does that mean to say we should go beyond the letter of the law? And what does that say about the law? What's the point in having a law if we're saying at the same time we should really go beyond the letter of the law? And the question is strengthened by the idea that we have this portrayed as some type of an obligation. So if we were just conveying that there is a higher standard that one could aspire to, it would be a little bit easier to understand. Right? The Ramban already alludes to that a little bit. We could say that we really have a higher ideal, but we can't expect that everyone's going to always live up to that ideal. So we need to have a basic minimum. That's the law. But at the same time, we can convey that we want you to reach for a higher standard, and therefore we'll give you the message that there is more to aspire to. And you'll recognize that those who really want to get on God's good side, so to speak, or those who really want to be admirable people, will shoot for that level. So that perhaps could be the case, but when we say that it's an obligation, which is what it sounds like from some of the passages, so then it becomes even harder to understand that if there is a obligatory beyond the letter of the law, so then what's the difference between that and the law? Let's just peg the law at a higher place. Yosef?
Kedoshim Kiyum, that makes it sound like it's a directive, it's an instruction,
correct.
It's an obligation. Right,
so that's a mitzvah. And to transfer it over to this context, v'asisa yasher v'hatov, so if that refers to lifnim meshuras hadin, as the Ramban invokes, and as the Gemara seems to say, there's an obligation of lifnim meshuras hadin, so what does that mean then? What does it say about the din? So why do we make the law less than what we're looking for, and less than what we're even mandating?
Can it not be the same idea, because then you would have two sources with the same teaching.
Why do we need these two psukim? Why do we
need... If Kedoshim Wanti have Kedoshim Tiyu, so wouldn't we deduce from there that...
Kedoshim Tiyu is really a different context. Kedoshim Tiyu is more about between you and God. So that's about holiness. But let's say Vayisiso Yashuv HaTov, so that's about our interpersonal behavior, but also in this week's Parsha, Samaisa Asher Yasun, that Lefnim Meshur Sadin, so that sounds like two separate sources. And that's something to try to figure out.
No, but maybe that's not so difficult, because... I just realized, in the one in Vasisa Yashar Atov, that's Hashem talking, that's a tzivui, that's a commandment from Hashem, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that could be Beinadam L'chaveiro.
So it's a commandment from Yisro.
Maybe that's not a commandment. That's Yisro just saying it's something that you should teach them, but the later on we have the actual instruction from Abed Baruch, that this is something which has to be kept as a real mitzvah.
So you're saying that things shifted, so now the din is no longer the din?
So now, this one, Asher Tasun, that you have in Parshas Yisro.
But in the same pasuk, right? You're saying there's a din and there's the masa asher yasun. There's a din and there's a fnid mishur sadin in the same breath. And so, what's the point in having two standards?
No, because I'm saying the one from Yisro you can't really learn so much from because it's him.
Those are both in the same pasuk. In the same pasuk in Yisro, it says hamaisa asher yasun, and the Gemara says maisa that is the din, and asher yasun that's the fnid mishur sadin. So in the same breath, you're being told, follow the law and go beyond the law. So the question is, if you have these two standards, so why don't we just make the law that? Ilan, I think you go first.
Wouldn't you be able to say then that the law is a law, that that's what you're meant to do, mm-hmm. but there's a separate, completely separate prohibition of, in certain cases, there is a precept of nudity from Indian men. In certain instances, you should, while you can't always, there are certain instances where you should.
So I think that's definitely a part of it, right? That there are circumstantial differences, and that may shift what your obligation is. So we mentioned last week that the Gemara in Bava Metzia, those who are in Bava Metzia, so the Gemara has a story of Rabbi Baruch Hanna, whose workers broke his stuff, and he held on to their clothes, and Rav told him that he has to give them back their clothes. And when he said, "Is that really the law?" he was told, "Yeah, for you it's the law. That Laman Telchu B'Derech Tovim, you have to go on the good path." And then, not only did they want to get their clothes back, but they wanted to be paid. And he was told, "Yes, you have to pay them." And he said again, "Dina Hachi, that's the law, really?" And the response was, "Yes, Vorchos Sadikim Tishmor, you should follow the paths of the righteous." So there, the impression you get is that he was told, this is what you got to do. This is above and beyond. They broke his stuff. They caused him big loss. And yet, he has to pay them. Clearly seems to be above and beyond. And yet, he's told, this is the din. Brad, you have a question?
Yeah, we should follow the path of the righteous. Are we saying that only applies to certain people? Or are we saying, because he was who he was? Or are we saying that it applies to everybody? Because everyone should at least aspire to be righteous.
Right, so that's kind of an open question from there. So it's not 100% clear, and that's part of what we need to figure out. So what is the implication of that Gemara? Hi.
Then it says you have to do this, and it says to go above and beyond. So mm-hmm. I think it's maybe like three ideas. That first of all is to educate us. Bare minimum, you have to do this, but what's the purpose of this? To get to this. To get to a point where you're doing good just for the sake of good or so. You have to do the bare minimum. If you steal this thing, you have to pay him back, whatever it is, double that, you damage you. But what's really right, to be happy when you do it, to realize that there's a purpose you're paying him back, to inspire you what the ideal should be of it. The second one is to...
So that's all, you know, very well and good, except that we don't find that we're talking necessarily about feelings. We find that we're talking about actions.
Or the way that you do the actions improperly.
But it's not even about that. It's about doing different actions, right? It's about paying workers so you wouldn't have to pay otherwise.
Maybe that base thing doesn't have to get you, or they have to go to... Rava, like we said, that you should optionally say, well, I did it, okay, fine, no, I'm letting them keep their clothes clean, that's really the right thing. Bare minimum, no. What I should do, yes. So it teaches you where you should be going, which is why it comes afterwards.
Okay.
And the second idea is that you have to have a bare minimum to uphold society. You can't require people to want to do good, but to say, if you broke his thing, you absolutely have to pay him back. So the basis you have to have, or society won't function properly.
And how do you define one as one and one as the other?
Well, that's set down in law, no? Torah Shigafra, O Torah Shigafra.
But, so then is the second level obligatory, or is it just for people who are aspiring to...
Okay, so that's the ideal, but the minimum is that you have to pay someone back if you damage their things. Right? So, depends again how you're going to do it.
But here he's telling that the people who damaged his stuff don't have to pay.
Here...
The workers damaged the boss's stuff.
And they don't have to pay.
Right.
Well, eventually they'd have to pay him back, no?
Not
and
necessarily.
That was part of their job, that if they break something, that's
not necessarily. That was the point. Okay. That really, strictly speaking, letter of the law, they're obligated to pay for what they broke.
Right, but
was instructed, he didn't decide to do this on his own, right? The boss was told that he should let them keep their property, in other words, not pay,
right.
And then, beyond that, he should pay them their salary for the day.
Okay, fine.
So that's a higher standard. So
right.
How do you figure out...
Okay, maybe that in that one case, he's telling him, you're great. You should be holding yourself to a higher, right? It was a famous... It was another famous rap, like, rough, no?
So that's one possibility. We have to figure that out.
He's saying, you got to be realistic. Look who you are. Give them their clothes back. Probably pretty wealthy, right?
So that's part of what we have to figure out. Is this a standard just for him? Or does it represent some kind of basic that is inherent in the law?
Okay.
So... There is, as Yosef was pointing out, we see already a couple of different sources addressing what seems to be the same concept, and we see some mixture of impressions as to whether this is basic behavior or above and beyond kind of behavior. And Tosfos on the side of the page above Metzia and Daf Chav Daled addresses it a little bit, and tries to figure out different categories. So the whole concept of where the law is and when you go above and beyond the law. So Tosa suggests, maybe you could say, that there are, say, three categories, Tosfos first suggests. That sometimes you have a circumstance where the law requires you to do something, but for whatever reason you happen to be exempted. There's a loophole, there's an exception that applies to you. So you could choose to do it anyway, to not avail yourself of this exception. So that's Hamaisa Asher Yasun. That's what the pasuk in this week's parasha is telling us, that we should try, even if we personally are not obligated. Let's say, for example, might possibly be an example of returning lost property. So you have a mitzvah of returning lost property, but there are some circumstances where you personally might be exempted. So, says Tosfos, in such a case, it's better, Hamaisa Asher Yasun, Lefnim Mir Asher Sadin, that you should give it back. Abraham, right?
Yeah. Did you already start talking about the Tosfos in the first paragraph?
No, in the second paragraph.
Second
paragraph? Yeah. In Chavdala. Yeah. So, that's one standard. Then there's another standard where it's not necessarily the case that anyone's obligated, but there's no loss to you. There's no monetary loss, and it's clearly going to help someone else. So then, that's still appropriate. That's the next level. Then there's another level where you will incur a big loss or a significant loss. But circumstances clearly call for it and you're capable of doing it. So then that's what the Gemara is saying here in the end in Peidal and Bav Metzia, that Orcha Sadikim Tishmor, that's a higher level. Those who are able to should aspire for that. So, it seems to emerge that you have a couple of different concepts at play here. Hi.
Can you just give those few different levels again?
Yeah, one level is something that's normally obligatory, but for some reason you're exempt at the moment. The next level would be, it's not really an obligation, but it doesn't hurt you at all, so you might as well do it. And then beyond that is, it does cost you something, but decency indicates that you should do it, and you're capable of doing it. That's the higher standard that the Gemara seems to be talking about in terms of Rabbi Bavar Chana.
So, which one is Nave 3 in two classifications?
Right, so with three, the middle one they don't have a pasuk for. The middle one, Tosfos doesn't attach to any pasuk. But the one in this week's parasha, Maisha Sheri Asun, says that refers to a case where it's a general requirement and you happen to right now be exempt.
That would be the lowest
level. Yeah, that's the lowest level. That's the least we can ask of you. And then you want to go a step beyond. It's not really an obligation, but it's not going to cost you anything. And then a step beyond that is where it will cost you something, but still seems to be the right thing to do. So what seems to emerge is that there are different ways of getting at what's Lefnim Meshur HaSadin. There are different circumstances, and there are different kinds of Lefnim Meshur HaSadin. There are different factors that may show you that something is indicated. Like you might have, on the one hand, that in other areas of life this is asked for, and just for whatever reason now it's not being required of me. But we see from the Torah that this is a value in general. Whatever it is, la shavas aveda, and returning lost property, or whatever it is. And there are settings where it's not so obvious that this is a general requirement, but there is compassion involved. And that's really an external consideration. That if you're rich and they're poor and they're going to starve, so then the circumstances are different, and that imposes a whole different level of requirement on you. Yosef?
What is the extent of that, though? Because you can have some billionaires who, mm-hmm. they'll never stop giving them, but there's a certain, isn't the halakha appreciate to some extent the wealth of it doesn't mean you need to give away your wealth. So
the question is, what do you mean by give? Your question is a reasonable question to ask in general when it comes to tzedakah. You know, what exactly are the limits of a charitable requirements? And even though the Gemara says that in general we tell you to cap stuck at 20% because more than that we're afraid that you're going to bankrupt yourself. But then the Pope's going to do right that somebody who's a billionaire, somebody who's such a level of wealth, he could give away 99% of his money and still have 10 times as much as anyone else, isn't subject to limitations. That's a fair question to ask in general. Where do your charitable obligations stop? But here we're not even up to that yet. Here we're up to, it's not a question of you're giving to poor people, but you're interacting with people and who's right? You have a conflict with somebody, let's say. There's a clash between your rights and their rights. And strictly speaking, your rights win out. But he's going to starve and you're not going to starve. So then, how does it play out? That's essentially what we're talking about.
Close to the objective charity things.
Correct, right. So what's also interesting, if we look at the Lifnei Meshuras Hadin component, so we see that there is a debate among the Rishonim. Some Rishonim, such as the Mordechai, maintained that not only is it obligatory to go Lifnei Meshuras Hadin, but Beis Din will actually enforce it. And others ask the question, which is probably a self-evident question, if Beis Din enforces it, so then what's the difference between the Din and the Lifnei Meshuras Hadin?
Which level is the Mordechai referring to? The Ma'aseh Shagasim?
So it's not clear. He actually says it based, he says it in the second paragraph above Messiah, but he quotes the story about Rabbi Baruch Hanan. So that's especially a little tricky to figure out, to say that, but that's what it sounds like from the Gemara, that it's being imposed on him. Dina Hafi. So who's it going to be imposed on? So that's why this was a big debate. So the Beis Yosef and others asked on him, and they quoted the Rush and Rabbeinu Yerucham, that we don't apply kfiyah, we don't apply compulsion for Lifnei Meshuras Hadin, because again, if you're going to do that, so then what does it mean to have Lifnei Meshuras Hadin? That is the din. What's the difference between having a din, which you can compel, and then call it not the din itself? Brad?
Just another example of this that just comes to mind is in Makos, we don't necessarily put somebody to death with means of Beis Din, but Beis Din will still kill him through different means. So it's another example.
Yeah, that's really addressing a different consideration. Now, there, the Gemara wants to figure out what are you going to do about a situation where somebody is Chayiv Misa, but he doesn't fit the technical requirements. So since there is a concept that Beis Din is required to protect everyone's safety and to enforce the Torah even when they don't fit all the requirements for execution, the Gemara calls Beis Din Makin V'Onshin Shalom and Adin, so then they would find other ways to deal with it.
I thought the implication or the context of the Gemara was that they're doing everything they can to not give a Mises Beis Din. So,
which were you talking about the Gemara about where somebody was Chayav Misa, other things, that other things would happen to him, that Gemara, or the Gemara about the Kippah?
The end of the first paragraph, I think it's in Tosos, where they were feeding barley. And
right, the Kippah Gemara. So there, the person's a danger to society, and they don't have a way to practically convict him. So then there's another track, that essentially Beis Din has the obligation to protect society, even when they can't impose the kapara punishment that the Torah is requiring. So that's, they have another way of dealing
so
with...
only in the Kippah case?
No, there are other examples, but they have a general principle of Beis Din Makim V'Onshin Shalom Ben Adin,
right,
which, as the Ran explains in one of his drushes, that we have different tracts of how Beis Din deals with society. So we have the formalized rules, which are about kapara and have all kinds of other details with them. And then when that's not possible, but somebody is a danger, somebody's going to go continue committing crimes, so then they have to deal with them on a different track. So it does have some parallel here. It's a little bit of a different context, but it has some parallel that we have certain absolutes that we need to put there for society as a whole. But then there are circumstantial differences, and we have to know how to respond to those circumstantial differences. So then maybe Beis Din will even go so far as to enforce those circumstantial differences. And that seems to be what Mordechai is coming from. Hi.
Wouldn't you say that the Mordechai then clearly holds, like the Ramban, that it's an obligatory thing? Because where else do you find that Beis Din will impose or enforce something that's not written as an actual obligation?
Well, that's why the other Rishonim are trying to figure out what he's talking about. Now, that's what
why is it so strange then?
Because if something is beyond the law, so then how can once Bezin's going to force you to do it, so then that, by its very definition, is the law.
Right, so then he'll hold like the Ramban. He'll say that it's part of the law.
But the Ramban also uses the phrase, Lefnei Mishur HaSadeh. And we have to figure out what exactly is the hierarchy.
It's just cemented. It's just like a it's part of Sisa Yashar Tov.
But what does that mean then? You know, so does Sisa Yashar Tov just mean that there are circumstantial differences, or that there are details that we can't prescribe in advance, so we have to let us figure that out on our own? So that's part of what we have to figure out. So some suggest that Rabbi Akiva Eiger, for example, in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, so he suggests that really there is not much of a machlokas here, because there's kfiyah and there's kfiyah, that Beis Din won't really enforce it in a practical sense. It means that Beis Din will declare it, will tell you that really if you're a good person, this is what you should do, and we think you're a terrible person because you're not doing this, but they won't use the same enforcement mechanisms that you find elsewhere. Others suggest, the Bach thinks that, the Bach commenting on the tour, that really everyone agrees that kfiyah is sometimes appropriate. And the question is just the circumstances. That if we're dealing with a rich person who could be helping out a poor person, so then kfiyah, he thinks everyone agrees that, even the Rush would agree, that that's something we should compel. That's a very striking idea. Because the Mordechai doesn't sound like that. And other Rishonim don't like that. Sound like that. Other Rishonim sound like if something is beyond the requirements, then it's up to you to decide to rise to that level, but it's not something we're going to actually mandate. So it's also interesting to note that there are different kinds of Lifnei Mishur HaSadeh, in addition to what Tosfos said before, but there are different reasons why something might be beyond the law. And I think this really fits into a larger question one could ask, that if you're going to say that there's a difference between the letter of the law and what we really want you to do, I think there are at least two different reasons why you might say that. One reason, like we said before, is circumstances. That we have an objective rule when dealing with Reuven versus Shimon, John Doe versus Bob Doe. But when we're dealing with rich Mr. Goldberg and the widow Schwartz, then really justice requires something else. So the situation itself is such that the law really would have responded differently if we could take these factors into consideration. Reuven, I think you're up first.
Yeah, that Bach that Reuven mentioned before, isn't that like against
So that's a fascinating question in general. Right, so when the Torah says that you're not supposed to decide, okay, this guy's rich, this guy's poor, so therefore the poor guy wins, the rich guy loses, so that is true in terms of the basic judgment. But what's being conveyed here, and it's also part of the reason why others won't agree with the Bach, others won't agree with the Mordechai, is saying that, yes, in terms of who's right and who's wrong, you're right and he's wrong. But you have an obligation to address his needs also, and therefore you should not stand on your rights.
And we can tell you through the din.
Correct, and we can tell you. Right, otherwise, the Gemara by itself seems to be a contradiction to that whole idea. Right, the Rabbi Baruch Hanan Gemara by itself is going to raise these questions even before we get to the Bach or before we get to the Rush. Right, so it seems to be that, yes, that what he's saying, that there's a personal obligation for you to Orcha Sadikim Tishmur, etc. Yes and no. V'hafla Recha Kamocha probably addresses other realms. V'hafla Recha Kamocha, it's a big machlokas what that means also, because as some of the Rishonim note, the Rambam understands V'hafla Recha Kamocha as the source for all the obligations of chesed and everything that we do for each other. And others point out that it's a difficult standard, because if kamocha means equal to yourself, so it's practically impossible to do for even one other person in the world what you do for yourself. So what does that mean in reality? So others understand it like the Gemara in Shabbos has the negative formulation, that you should not do bad things to others that you don't want to do for yourself. So what exactly the impact of V'ahavta l'recha kamocha is in general, especially in the monetary realm, is an interesting question. Now, there are those who say, based on Dolzi Shan rather than the Rambam, that essentially it presents itself as an Isser, and it's, even though it sounds like the most positive mitzvah in the Torah, it's really a negative mitzvah. Don't do to others bad things, and how do we define these bad things based on what you wouldn't want to do for yourself? But then, part of what's tricky is, so then it's sometimes difficult for a person to say, all right, so I'm rich, so I don't care if I pay for my damages. You know, why shouldn't the poor guy, if I broke something, I'd pay for it, so let the poor guy also pay for it. So having that awareness is part of the challenge here. So when you talk about a lifnim b'shuras hadin obligation, it can come from a couple of places. It can come from a recognition that really this is the nature of what should be. But because there are so many variables in life, we can't codify that, so we have to codify things in a certain basic way. But in real life, justice would require something else sometimes. I'll give you an example. Let's say Hashavas Aveda. So when it comes to returning lost property, so if any of you learn in the second parak above Metziah, it can be a little striking if you see all the exceptions to the obligation of Hashavas Aveda. And so we have a concept, for example, this idea of Yeish, that if the original owner has given up hope on getting the property back, so you're not obligated to return it. So that may strike someone as very unjust. The guy shows up and you know it's his and you have his thing. So how could you not give it back to him? So indeed, our practice is, based on the Gemara and based on the latest sources as well, that we do give it back to him. That we say, Lifnim Meshur Sadin, you should return it even after Yeish. So we do give it back. So, again, so why do we have the Din of Yeish? And how do you understand the letter of the law and going beyond the letter of the law? So what's probably involved there is that you have these rules, Yeish and the like, that if you're going to have a property conflict, two people could theoretically have a claim to the same item. Somebody lost it. He has a claim that was originally his. And somebody else found it, and there was no way to identify who to go back to. So you have lost property that doesn't have an owner, so you're allowed to keep it. So you have two people who have a valid claim to something. So we have to draw the line somewhere. We have to say, at one point we're going to decide, on this side of the line it's Reuven's, on that side of the line it's Shimon's. And we have to have an objective standard. But there'll be a circumstance where, look at the guy's right here, and you know it's his, and he's crying, and this is a childhood doll that he loved his whole life. So you'll know that, okay, going beyond the basics, this is something that I really should give back. We can't codify this in Shulchan Aruch, because we can't say, well, Yeish, normally you can keep it, unless it's the guy's childhood teddy bear and he's crying. You know, we're going to have to have some kind of objective standards. So we have objective standards for what the bottom line is. But the circumstances will still sometimes present themselves that you need to go beyond that. So that's one type of lifnim meshuras hadin. There's another type, which may be that, look, strictly speaking, you're allowed to act in such a way. But there are other reasons not to. From outside other areas of halacha or other areas of Jewish philosophy. Such as, for example, Rachmanis. Now, if you know there's a poor person who's going to starve, right, so then that's a little bit of a different case. Let's say if you want to look at the case of Rabbi Bar Chana, so it's a little different than the Hashavas Aveda example. That here, one person breaks somebody else's stuff, it's pretty clear that the person who does the breaking should do the paying. That's not so much a question of circumstances. But it's also clear that these people are going to go home starving, and the wealthy owner who lets that happen, what kind of effect is that going to have on his soul? What kind of effect is that going to have on his compassion? So his character, his v'halachta b'drachav, which means you should imitate God, you should follow his path, it's also derived from the same pasuk in this week's parasha, as well as last week's parasha, Zekei Levi and Vehu, from both places. So we have other halachic reasons why you can't let a poor person starve. Right, so, therefore, yes, in terms of the laws of broken property, he gets to keep their wages. But in terms of the laws of basic compassion, he can't go through with that. So there you have a lefnim ashuras adin, which comes from a different place, so to speak. You hear the difference between the two cases? In one case, the lefnim ashuras adin is saying the rules of this situation should be altered. And in the second case, it's lefnim ashuras adin, meaning that the rules of this interaction are what they are. But for other compelling halachic reasons, you shouldn't act that way. You can't let this person go home starving. The Sridi Eish, just to comment on that, the Sridi Eish, you know, was a great posek who lived 50 years ago, Rechel Yaakov Weinberg. So in one of his tshuvas, it's in Chelek Aleph, and Simon Kuf Chav Tes, so he has a short tshuva where he says that he talks about in general, how do you figure out what is the letter of the law, what's mishpat, he says, and what is musar, and what is an ethical consideration that we try to factor in. So he says, in general, it's hard to know where the line is, and it's hard sometimes to impose it too much on other people who can't figure it out on their own. But he says, it is a din in the Torah, that, for example, the Torah says when you have a mashkon, you have a collateral that you're holding on for a loan, and somebody else borrowed money from you, so you have his stuff, but he needs the stuff, it's his pajamas, he needs the stuff to sleep at night. So the Torah says, you should give it back to him to use at night. Because otherwise, what's he going to sleep with? Bama yishkav. So he says, what's that whole phrasing mean? The whole phrasing means is that, letter of the law, it's yours. He borrowed the money from you, so you get to keep his collateral. But the way the whole phrasing of the pasuk goes, what's he going to sleep in? You know, have some compassion. Understand that there are other considerations also, and that also has to factor into your behavior. So it seems that there really are two different types of lefnim ashuras adin that are being addressed here. There are times when really the local area, whether it's lost property, whether it's basic labor rights and paying somebody who broke stuff, etc. So the law itself, in this circumstance, would probably call for something else. And then there are other cases where the law would stay as it is, but your character requires you to act in a different way. Your character requires you to have more compassion, and therefore you're going to behave differently. And in general, there's a question some of the later Sfarim ask. So let's say when you have lefnim ashuras adin, let's say by Hashavas Aveda. But Hashavas Aveda is an area where it comes up a lot. Again, it says in Shulchan Aruch, and it says in the commentaries to Shulchan Aruch, the Shach and others, that nowadays we do return lost property even after the person has given up hope, etc. So is that a halacha in Hashavas Aveda? Or is that a different halacha? It's a personal obligation, which could have some possible implications. For example, do you have to announce it? Right, if you find lost property, you're allowed to keep. You don't have to declare it. You don't have to announce it. So if you were saying that really you should give it back because of lefnim mishuras adin, so should we also say you have to announce it? Sounds like from the rush in the second parak above and see that you do. So perhaps that's the question that we're talking about. Is lefnim mishuras adin mean the parameters of this concept expands? Or does it mean that, no, this is a personal obligation for you to act differently? And it probably depends on what kind of lefnim mishuras adin we're talking about. Are we talking about one that the circumstances really just call for a different decision, and you have to recognize that? Or are we talking about the fact that your personal character requires you to act differently? Eitan?
Just to understand the differences, mm-hmm. So for the first kind that you said that the halacha should be altered, so that means that there is a halacha and we're changing it?
So it means that the halacha is addressing the basic scenario, Reuven and Shimon, two abstract people. But, so let's say, to use that example again of Yeish, we have to draw the line somewhere. You can't have a situation where if I find lost property and there's no owner around and I have no reason to think he's ever going to show up, and I keep it and I build this into my house, and then he shows up 2 years later and says, that's mine, you got to give it back, that's not fair to me. Right? So basically, as a finder and as the loser, you have a clash between two people who have rights to something. And we have to draw the line somewhere. We have to say, when is it going to become the rights of the finder? When does the finder have the right to say, it's not logical, it's not reasonable to think you can give this back, you can keep it? Because there's no value in having the object be no one's. Right? So either we can give it back to its original owner, or if that's not reasonable, we should let the finder keep it. So how do we know when the finder can keep it and when he has to give it back? So we have to have some basic standard. But what if there's a situation where we say, okay, that standard has been met? To give a different example that's not a part of the letter of law here, let's say we were to say, just to make it simpler, let's say we were to say that the halacha is that within 30 days, if a guy claims that you have to give it back, after 30 days you can assume no one's going to claim it and you can keep it. Right, so then let's say 30 days pass, and 1 minute later, the guys are pulling out. The guy shows up, and he's crying, and this is his heirloom for generations. So strictly speaking, letter of the law, it's yours, right? We said 30 days was the cutoff. But you see, the guy just missed it. He was stuck in traffic, and this is his. And really, if we could have made the law based on this one circumstance, it would have been 31 days. But
that's not the second type?
No, that's more the first type, that you know, if the law could have been made just for this case, it would have been returned to him. But because we have to have abstract rules, so we set the line somewhere else. While the second type would be that, no, really, let's say the guy broke your property, so you should pay. Anybody who broke your property, the person who broke it should pay. But he's also poor, so you have to have compassion. It's going to make a much bigger difference to him than it is to you. So then you have an externally motivated kind of lifnim mishur hadin. Yosef?
Sounds like the second one is based on the first one, no? That in either of those situations that you gave, let's talk about the guy who shows up a minute after the 30 days are over. So the reason why you have a personal obligation is because of the circumstance. Meaning that's why you might say that it's incumbent upon you to act differently than the letter of the law because of the circumstance. So doesn't the circumstance really then... Isn't that the driving force behind the Mishuris and
Dem
in both scenarios?
Yeah, not really, because the first one is more that the circumstances of this case are different. You know, that if this were the only case in the world, the law would have been in his favor. And just because we had to draw the line objectively, it was somewhere else. While in the second case, it's not really true. Really, the facts of the case are in your favor. Because of objective reasons, not just because we had to draw the line somewhere. The guy broke your stuff. The Rabbi Baruch Hanna's workers, they broke his barrels. They owe him. But what would it do to his character to let these people go home starving when he's rich? He'll be fine. And they're going to go home with nothing to eat. Where's your decency? So anything that's going to be decency motivated, so to speak.
So it's really, the motivation is two separate things. One is... In the first case, the circumstance is to benefit the person who would be losing out if you follow the letter of the law.
Right.
And the second one, it's the person who would be hurting someone else.
Saying who's the beneficiary.
Yeah, the beneficiary, then it's like aimed at two separate people.
That's possible. It's possible to read that into it. You could also discuss that in greater detail and see if that's 100% true, but that's a valid point. So you find discussions in Poskim in general about whether or not there is a concept of kofin, whether or not we force lifnim mishuris hadin. That's a machlokus harishonim, and then you have later poskim who say that everyone agrees, it's just a question of what level of kfiya will you use. Maybe everyone agrees that the Bezdin should make clear what they think is really right. And you also have those who distinguish between rich people and poor people, which seems to go more to the second type a little bit, that if a person is wealthy and the other guy is poor, so let's say with Hashavas Aveda, if the guy who lost it is poor and the guy who found it is rich, so then we will compel him to return it. Some make the distinction based on that factor, which really seems to introduce this other level of lifnim mishuris hadin, that you should have compassion on the person who's going to suffer. So... You're a billionaire and you find this guy's wallet and it wasn't identifiable at the time, and now he shows up and this is all the money he has in the world. So, yeah, really it's yours, but compassion is not gonna allow this guy to starve while you just have one more wallet to add to your billions. So that basic compassion, the basic decency, when it adds a whole other element, That seems to be a different type of lifnim mishuras hadin. So trying to identify these different elements is a major part of how we are going to make our decisions in life. That we're going to try to understand what the dinim are about, try to understand what is the underlying logic in every case, and therefore hope that our decisions, first of all, at least comport to the letter of the law, but then also to the extent that we can recognize an intent of the law, because, again, these are laws that we have some capacity to understand, to try to act in accordance with that. And then try to also recognize if there is other, if there are other considerations of our character, of our decency, of our compassion, and the like, to act accordingly. So therefore you also find that the idea of an Adam Chashiv, you have a person who's of stature, a person who's considered to be a very holy person, a person who's considered to be on a high level, so sometimes his obligations will be considered to be greater. The Lifnim Mishuras HaDin will act on that level. And that especially seems to reflect when there are other personal considerations. A person who's a very distinguished person should be a compassionate person, should be a sensitive person, should be a decent person. So all of those requirements that come from that angle are going to especially apply to a person on that level, to a person on that stature. So it's also interesting, some note that, so the Ramban, as we said before, seems to say that going lifnim mishuras hadin is obligatory, while the Rambam usually has a focus where he talks about it being amidas chasidus. This is an action of special piety. So it sounds like in the Rambam's reading, it's not that they're obligatory, but that it reflects a higher standard by which one could aspire to live. And then there are those who suggest, as kind of a compromise, that the Rambam will also acknowledge that a person who's already perceived as being on a higher level, it will be an obligation to act this way. It will be an obligation to act lifnim mishuras hadin. So part of what we need to figure out is what are our basic obligations, what are the values that this particular law conveys, and how on top of them are we? And then also, what other personal considerations do we have that may push us to act in an even more refined manner, an even more elevated manner? And sometimes there'll be different indications, and sometimes they'll push us in different directions. So I think it's also important to understand whether something is inherent to a certain concept or coming from a different reason. So, for example, if, let's say, you're dealing with a case of Hashavas Aveda, or you're dealing with a case of labor rights and the like, so if it's lifnim mishuras hadin for internal reasons, that really this halacha, if this were the only case, it would be applied more on the other person's side, so then that's a higher level of obligation than when it's coming from your personal needs for your personal character development. Because what will you do if you have other responsibilities? And that's a part of what we need to figure out, that when we talk about Jewish business ethics, so the very premise is that you are not only obligated to maximize your profit, but you have obligations towards others. But there are many possible others. There are a number of possible others, probably at least three or four candidates for others. So if I say that as a Jewish business person, you have obligations to someone else, who could you have an obligation to besides yourself? There's a couple of possibilities. Avi?
God.
God. Okay, so that's definitely,
like,
right, that's definitely step one. But even other human beings, what other human beings could you have an obligation to? I think it was Joseph, Brett. Joseph.
Competition or people less fortunate.
Okay, those are two separate kinds of people. So let's say one at a time. Okay.
Opposite.
Yes, so you have obligations towards your competition. Other business people, you may have rules to how you relate to them. Right? There may be things that you could do that would violate their rights. So hold on, let's take one at a time. So that's one other person who you have to worry about, your competition. Yosef?
I missed the case.
The question is that the whole premise of a Jewish business ethic is that you're not only obligated to maximize your profit and to worry about yourself, but you're obligated towards others. You have responsibilities towards other people. And again, I don't want to claim that there's only Jewish business ethics. You know, the claim of all ethics in the world is you have obligations towards others. But we're just talking about Jewish business ethics. So who else could you have an obligation to in a business context? So far, your competitors. Yes, who else?
Investors.
Yes, that's true, right? Investors or partners. You could have other people who are in this with you who also you have obligations to. Right?
Could your employees?
Employees, absolutely, right? That would be a third category.
The person you're dealing in business with, the consumer?
Yes, the consumer. So there already you have four categories who you could have obligations to. And the first one that you mentioned, God, obviously on top of everything, but you could take that separately also. Let's take that all about for a moment, okay? Five separate categories of others to whom you have obligations. So first of all, you could have an obligation to your customer. Let's mention that first because that's the most basic. You are interacting with another person in a business transaction. So you have obligations towards that person. Not to cheat that person, not to deceive that person, to provide the service that you're representing, etc., etc. Everything that you would have in that category. Second, you could have other people who are sharing this endeavor with you, investors or partners alike. And therefore, that's important because you have obligations towards them, you know, to give them their fair due and the like. But also, that redefines your own personal obligations. Because if you were in business by yourself with no investors and no partners, you would have greater latitude to make decisions as you see fit. But if you have a partner or an investor, that radically shifts the level of obligation you have. Now you're not just responsible to yourself for the decisions that you make in your own interest. Your interest is shared by others. That radically redefines things. So your customers and your partners slash investors. And what about, as was mentioned, your employees? So now you have human beings who you are engaging with, who in a business context you interact with. So we know that the Torah has many obligations regarding them, which are also not necessarily about maximizing your profit. And, as was mentioned, your competition. There are laws governing how you can fairly compete with others. Whether they are the laws of Hasagas Gvul, of unfair, ruinous competition, or the Lashon Hara components that may apply if you're going to defame the competition or create for yourself some type of unfair advantage. So that's a fourth category. And obvious category of God is also, besides being all-encompassing, but also represents the fact that sometimes you'll have responsibility just to the value system, that you have to create a Kiddush Hashem, so to speak, and you have to uphold the values and the reputation of Judaism and of God's message. So that itself will impose responsibilities. So you have at least five categories of others that are beyond the profit motive, beyond what Adam Smith talked about, and the halacha could regulate all five of those arenas. But sometimes they are going to be at odds with each other. So if I am more generous to my employees, that will come at the expense of my partners. Or if I am more respectful of my competition, that could come at the expense of my partners and my employees. Or if I am more generous to my competition, that may come at the expense of my customers. Right? That's one you could easily envision, right? That maybe my customers will benefit from more aggressive competition. So what we have is an interlocking set of priorities and values. The halacha values all of these relationships and regulates all of these relationships, right? In each one of these categories, I gave you a few examples, but in each one of these categories, you can imagine halachas that regulate them. I think we gave at least one example for each one, right? In each one of these categories, you have halachas that regulate them. So what's going to happen if they interfere with each other?
Joseph? Into them, the first, the last class, the lesser, one that causes the lesser damage, like the value.
Sometimes, but then so also knowing where the din and where the lefnim ashuras hadin is going to play a role. So, for example, if let's say I want to act lefnim ashuras hadin with my company, I want my company to do something above and beyond the law. So that sounds great, but what if that means now my partners are going to get less than they're entitled to? Is that my right to decide?
Or wouldn't you say that everyone, those recipients have a right to you keep adhering to at least the basic standard of law? And
what does at least mean? It's a trade-off. You know, so my customers and my partners may be in conflict with each other.
I mean, as long, to the point where if you have to, if by going with Nimi Shuras Adin you're going to be, I guess, hurting someone, then wouldn't you say then you can't go with Nimi Shuras Adin, even if according to, for whichever particular party is going to benefit from you doing that, but you don't have a right to do that if it's going to be stepping on the toes of somebody else.
So you have to figure out, right, you have to figure out what's called stepping on the toes and what's called expense. So that's part of the question. Right. So to what extent does a company owner have the right? It was also a major debate. You know, in general, Milton Friedman, the famous economist, had very strong feelings about. This is something that Rabbi Levine wrote extensively about, and also our director, Dr. Pava, has written a lot about, very extensively. So is it right for a company owner to engage in social activism? If he thinks that this is morally desirous, what he's going to do, but it's going to come at the expense of profits, so does he have the right to do anything that comes at the expense of profits if he's representing shareholders and partners?
Why would it come at the expense of profits?
Because it costs money. If he's going to say, I'm only going to buy green products, or I'm going to donate some of the company's money to whatever cause, so to what extent does he have the right to do that?
What about the owner of Chick-fil-A spoke out politically and then people started boycotting the whole?
Right, and there, so at least...
That was different, though. I mean, he just happened to say his political opinion.
He was using his stature. He wouldn't have been quoted in the news.
Right. But his point is well taken. Your point is well taken. But Abraham's point is well taken is that it's doubly indirect. Right, because first of all, he was just stating his views, not taking the company's money. Although that was
part of it.
Right, that was a part of it.
Except terrible contributions.
Yeah, though they just said this week that wasn't even happening. But the question is
just that Timberland does that, yeah. As a Jewish owner.
Correct, but so the question of to what extent can a company divert the resources to social projects, even if as a person they may be very desirable and they may be very character enhancing. So do you have the right to enhance your character at the expense of profits when it's your obligation to your stockholders and to your partners to make profit? So that's a complicated question, and it doesn't have an easy answer. One might suggest that there is a distinction in terms of when we talk about lefnim b'shuras hadin, so there's some kind of lefnim b'shuras hadin which really is what the din should be if it was just this case. And there's another kind where it's external, but it enhances my character to do it. So as an individual, I should do this. But does a company have the same standards? And if you're dealing not with a company, but let's say you're dealing with a charitable institution, so then you could say the stakes are even higher, that people donated to that institution charitable funds. So what right do I have to use the charitable funds in a way that's not absolutely required by the law? Am I basically taking stock of money and using it for something very nice, but not what the donors necessarily gave it to? And I think there is room to distinguish between the different types of lefnim b'shuras hadin. That you could say that it's reasonable for a company to say, we're not only going to do what we have to, but we will, within this area of law, act in an exemplary manner. But to say, we're also going to do other things that make us better people, maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe that's already outside of your charter. So I think that distinction makes a difference. Hi.
Also, just even if they aren't necessarily direct stakeholders within the company, let's say employees or other partners or investors, there's still different halachic standards with what you're allowed to do with the money. Just for if someone's not allowed to give more than a tip of their money to charity, or even if they're a billionaire, as far as
they have the basic fiduciary responsibility not to bankrupt the company.
I'm saying, assuming somebody isn't running a company with shareholders, and it's just, you know, they run a single person business, and it's totally up to them, they still can't give more than a fifth.
Is that true?
Yes and no. So as we alluded to before, the fifth requirement is subject to a lot of exceptions. So if a person can easily afford it, so the Chafetz Chaim writes that the exception doesn't apply to him. So there are a lot of exceptions, but there also you have to figure out on a corporate level just how it fits. And if a person is dealing, one of the things we'll also have to figure out as we go on, it's on our list, right, for topic five. I think we will have to get to this because it affects so many other things. What is a corporation in halacha? Do we recognize the idea that if two, three, four people get together and they create an entity, so is that a new entity that's not really Jewish, it's not anything? Or is that a group of four Jews that are subject to all of the laws that regulate that? Hi.
I think that we have this discussion in halacha itself. We have a guy who wants to give excessive shurma,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to take away from the miser he's going to give because it's percentage-based.
Right.
Wouldn't that play in over here as well?
It reflects the idea that everything comes at a balance. Right, so the question, so that it's an example of the idea that everything comes at the expense of something else. So especially in a business context, we have all kinds of reasons. It's true for any individual, but especially in a business context where we have so many different spheres going on at once. So we are going to have to figure out where we balance our different priorities, and it becomes very complicated. Right? It becomes that we recognize that we have obligations towards several groups of people, and figuring out how we best honor all those obligations means taking each one of them seriously, first of all, and then figuring out to what extent we have latitude to emphasize one more than the other in a given case, and to know what laws regulate the interaction between the two. And what's the difference between a positive and a positive obligation and a negative obligation not to hurt someone, which will usually be more absolute. And a positive obligation, which may be a little bit more murky. It gets back to the whole point about v'yahavt l'reicha kamocha. So those are some of the issues that the whole lifnim meshuras hadin question is going to affect. It is, in general, a discussion whether or not entities, rather than people, have the right to go lifnim meshuras hadin. And what's interesting is we do find in a lot of the halachic literature that not only is it assumed that entities do have the right to act lifnim meshuras hadin, but are obligated to act lifnim meshuras hadin, which is a fascinating idea. And that some understand it to be an extension of the Adam Chashuv idea. So if you think about that for a second, how could you understand that? How could you understand the idea that an entity such as a city or a company or a yeshiva or something like that could be obligated to act lifnim meshuras hadin, working within the existing categories that we've seen so far? You could have said the opposite. Rav Asher Weiss has a tshuva about this, where somebody asked him this question, is it legitimate for a stock organization to go lifnim meshuras hadin? And he pointed out from the tshuva Klem Sofer, from the tshuva Marsham and others, that apparently not only is it acceptable, but that you find this sometimes portrayed as an obligation. Like the Chassam Sofer has a tshuva, talks about paying the almana, the salary of the rabbi after he's no longer alive, and if it's not obligatory. And you have other tshuvas like that. So how could you understand, based on categories we've seen so far, why it should be not only mutter, but an obligation? So, Yosef and then Yonatan?
I think you can approach it in two ways. First of all, you have the Rambam, who talks about a righteous person, someone who keeps to a higher standard, might then it's an obligation. But I think maybe the point of that is that someone of influence, maybe, or someone of prestige, someone that people might look to, might to set their own standards, might have an obligation to act on a higher plane. And you know, entities such as business corporations, yeshivas, or cities who have that power to influence people who are a part of them might have an obligation then to, based on the same lines, even if they themselves aren't righteous people, but because they're people of influence, might have an obligation to set a standard. But I think that that might tie in with the second way we understood why you have to be lifnim meshuras hadin, not the circumstantial one, because of the personal obligation, which, again, once you assume that there's the responsibility on the person who's in that position to either act with permission or not, he himself has an obligation, added together with the Rambam, that's because he's a person of influence, that might, when, lead to some weight to that argument.
I think you're right. I think it's a large part of it, and that's certainly how some poskim have explained it, that the status of Adam Chashev, whatever reason we treat this distinguished person differently, carries over to an institution. An institution is a public standard bearer, is something that is held up and visible and people look to. And so we want that our institutions should be acting in a way that reflects the highest possible values, even though that comes at a cost, and even though these institutions are supported by charitable funds and reported by or stockholders and or investors. Nonetheless, that's a legitimate understanding and an expression of their mission in a legitimate way, and therefore that's considered to be value. And at times you want to say the same thing, different thing.
Well, some of this stuff is going to be a chiyuv on the other guy also too. If you have a partner and you want to do something better for the customer, so it's his deal, putting something better for the customer. So if it's a
right to a certain extent, although the question becomes how to what extent you have the right to figure that out. See, it becomes the same question that if we say there is a difference between the din and the finisher sadin, so it's hard for me to say, well, I can do it on his behalf because it's his obligation. If the whole theme is that it's voluntary to a certain extent, so it's not his obligation. So I choose to do it, maybe he doesn't choose to do it. So how exactly do you manage that? So that's a tricky question in general. But also there is the component that we see that two of the factors when you'll compel Lifnim Mishur Sadin, one was this Adam Chashev thing, and the other was if the person is an usher and the other person is an ani. So theoretically, that's generally the case when dealing with institutions, because an institution vis-a-vis an individual, it will generally be the case that the institution can absorb the loss more easily than the individual can. The individual will suffer, and you have an expression, ein ani yesh betzibur, the institution will not suffer. Now, of course, that's not a license for the people in charge to be irresponsible with the funds of the institution or to treat it as their own personal discretionary fund when it's not a discretionary fund. If it is, then it is. But if it's not, then it's not. But at the same time, it's a recognition that when the Lifnim Mishur Sadin considerations come into play, so it will generally be that the institution will be on the other side of the equation. Now, that's not always true. Sometimes whatever the Lifnim Mishur Sadin is asking for will be of such a nature that it will have a notable impact on the institution's ability to carry out its work. And that's going to make a difference. But in general, it's often viewed that way, that this ani-usher distinction tends to place the institution in the usher category, and they may be dealing with an ani, and therefore an institution that's an institution dealing with a poor person, very often Lifnim Mishur Sadin will ask it to have compassion. Rishonim already discussed that if you have a situation in Marach or Zeruah, some Rishonim discuss that if you have, it's legitimate, of course, for a city to collect taxes. And they could decide whatever the taxes are that they need to collect. At the same time, you have a poor person who can't afford it, so it's right for the city to have rachmanis on the poor person and to not drive him crazy for the taxes. So we have this idea in general, the institution, the entity will be viewed as a usher, and if they are dealing with an ani, so then the requisite compassion is appropriate and not a violation of the charter. Want to comment on that?
Maybe just in general, another way you could also say is that instead of asking why you can have someone else, if you're trying to go to the church, then maybe you go to the church, and if you're saying it's good to decide, so in general you have to do what's right. And if you have to have a situation that it only affects you, so then you can choose not to go to the church. You can't say that just because of my personal, that you have a choice to say that everybody else can't be the church.
I mean, like, if you're in charge of this institution and you decide not to go Lifnim Mishur Sadin, so they are all not Lifnim Mishur Sadin by compulsion. They're being forced to not go Lifnim Mishur Sadin. Right. So it's an interesting statement, although you can still cut both ways if they choose not to do it. But it ties in with the previous point that the institution as a standard bearer and something that's visible, so we would assume that everyone associated it would want that it should have its highest standard of behavior rather than necessarily maximizing its profits. But of course, there are going to be cases where the numbers are going to be completely out of whack, and if the institution is going to do too much of the Mishnah Tzedin, it's not going to be able to carry out its function. So that, of course, is going to have an impact as well. Or even just in a different sense, let's say you have an institution that's there to deal with genuine poor people. And if they are going to be too forgiving of their rights, even if the person they're dealing with is relatively poor, but now they're going to be disproportionately affected in how many poor people they can serve, so that's also a consideration. So there are all kinds of various elements that are going to come into play, but the general notion that there is some role for the Lifnei Meshuras Hadin with entities and institutions, even if they are either charitably supported or stockholder supported, has a lot of basis to it. Joseph, you wanted to...
Is there a criteria? I know we mentioned this regarding charity, so it's not relevant, but that part's not relevant, but is there some sort of extent that us all draw out for when the self-sacrifice for the sake of the Shnei Shuras Adin is too much? Is there some sort of criteria for when we would say, in the same way that we would
by
say...
By Tzedakah, yes,
you'd be a fool if you gave more, so... You can go to such an extent where you're hurting yourself and maybe even...
Right, so yes and no. I think to a certain extent it's part of the same equation, that if it's literally hurting you, then it's rarely going to be lifting Meshuras Adin. Because, so for example, we saw the Tosfos' distinctions with the different levels. So if we're talking about the middle category where there's no loss to you, so then by definition it's not hurting you. Right? And we saw the distinctions made between a Ani and an Asher. And some of the other cases where we have the whole Lifnei Meshuras Adin, if it's genuinely hurting you, it's going to be hard to come up with an example where that's actually Lifnei Meshuras Adin. And it's important to point out, since you raise it, especially in this context, that Lifnei Meshuras Adin, I hope it's come clear in this conversation, that it does not mean that you should always lose. Sometimes people see it that way, that it means that, okay, you should always be the sucker, you should always give up your rights, because you should always give in to the other guy. That's not what Lifnei Meshuras Adin means. Lifnei Meshuras Adin means there are circumstances where, even though you technically win, there are reasons why the other person should be spared, so to speak. But it does not mean that, oh, the halacha is, in this case, Reuven and Shimon, and Reuven wins, therefore Lifnei Meshuras Adin always means Shimon wins. You know, there are people who have that attitude, and it's a very unsophisticated attitude, and it makes the whole halacha turn on its head. So it's going to be hard to come up with cases where it really is Lifnei Meshuras Adin in a genuine sense, and it's hurting you. If it's hurting you, it might just mean that you're just not properly asserting your rights legitimately, which is not the same thing as Lifnei Meshuras Adin. So it is important to highlight that distinction. And you know, there's more to say about this introduction, but we have 10 minutes left today, so we'll just try to make one more point, and we'll at least announce the topic for next time so we fulfill our commitments. So again, the point that God is one of the five categories, and Kiddush Hashem is the constant mandate, that's also very important to keep in mind. And I want to say, as a general statement about all the topics that we're going to talk about, so for the most part, almost all of the values that we're going to address are going to apply equally whether you're talking about dealing with Jews or with non-Jews, and pretty much no matter who you're dealing with. Despite whatever distinctions you may find in the process, in the classical literature, for the most part, they are reasons that are not currently relevant. And the imperative, certainly in any issue of basic honesty and the like, but almost all the halachas that we're going to address in the course of this course, we should assume apply equally, at least in all the major details. A notable exception is Ribbis. Ribbis has some aspects to it that are uniquely relevant to Jews, and we'll highlight those when we talk about Ribbis specifically. But for the most part, and we'll talk about Davka, why that's different, and that hopefully should become clear. But for the most part, just about everything else that we're going to talk about, in practice, we're going to assume not only is equally relevant whether we're dealing with Jews or non-Jews, but especially so, we have the imperative of Kiddush Hashem, which puts even sharper focus on that and requires that all of our behavior be perceived as honest and just, especially if you're dealing with those who are not coming within the halachic system. And it's crucial to remember the exhortation of the Smak, which we'll refer to again later in the semester. But the Smak noticed that the Geula, that the redemption can only come when the Jews are perceived as an honest and forthright people with integrity. Because otherwise, how could God ever redeem the Jewish people? It'll be a Chil Hashem. The nations of the world will say, why is God redeeming this corrupt nation? Why is God taking this nation that's made up of dishonest people and holding them up as the messengers of the new world? That's not going to be possible. So if we want there to be a Geula, if we want the Jewish people to be able to fulfill their mission in any sense, so it's a key prerequisite that we recognize that perception is crucial. At the same time, as we said, I think, last time, talking about the first Rashi in Chumash, that we want the perception, but the perception isn't everything. Sometimes it won't be possible to be appreciated and perceived for our honesty. So then it's still crucial that we perceive ourselves as people of honesty and integrity. And that's why Rashi tells us in the first comment in Chumash that we should know that God created the world, so we have the right to Eretz Yisrael on that level. Halavai, it will be perceived that way, but even if it's not perceived, and sometimes you can't control how things are perceived, the world is not always fair that way, as we know. So we do what we can, because we recognize the crucial importance of both halves of that equation. So there's more one could say in terms of introductory concepts, but in the interest of time, we'll probably roughly leave it there. Any questions about anything we've said so far? All right, so let me introduce the next two topics, the next two sessions, but they have a strong connection between the two. So in the few minutes we have left today, I'll just start today's topic, but we'll continue next time. So topics 2 and 3 on our list are the topics of Onah/Mekach Tos and Gnevas Das. Those are different topics, but they are closely related. So we definitely want to discuss them in succession. They definitely have overlapping ideas. But they basically regulate our honesty in dealing with our business partners. Business partners in the sense of people who we are transacting with in business. Gnevas Das happens to be a much broader principle. Gnevas Das has to do with deception and dealing honestly, not only in terms of absolutes and monetary value, but also in terms of much broader considerations. So that has impacts in business, but also throughout our daily interactions. Onah starts off a little bit more specifically. I'm sorry, Tanya, you had a question?
You can just define Onah.
So Onah is hard to translate. The way we've translated in the past is price fraud. To define it literally, normally it means affliction, so oppression. Lo sonu isha samiso, it's a pasuk in Parshas Behar. We should not afflict each other, we should not oppress each other. So the Gemara in the fourth parak of Bava Metzia tells us we have two basic categories of onah. You have onas mamon, you have oppression in the monetary realm. That'll be most of our discussion. We also have a concept of onas dvarim, which means we can't inflict emotional pain on others. So that is a core Ben Adam L'Chaveru principle that is relevant not just to the business world, it's relevant all over the place. Maybe we'll mention where it has some specific business implications, but for the most part, we'll focus on Anas Mamon. So Anas Mamon, if I just left you to translate the phrase by yourself, monetary oppression, you could probably come up with a lot of things that would seem to meet the bill. The Gemara primarily discusses it in a way that could be best translated as price fraud. That essentially you are hurting the other party who you're dealing with because of price differentials. So that could come up in a number of ways. Either you are overcharging or you are underpaying. So it could refer either to the seller or the buyer, or you are underdelivering. So that could be a consequence of misrepresentation, that you charge a price that would be a reasonable price, but the product that you're giving is actually not the product that it seems to be. So because of one of the factors or the other, either a deficiency in the product, that's why we have Mekach Tos here under the heading, and that's where it also overlaps with Gnevas Das. So you are essentially cheating the other person, defrauding the other person in terms of the value that they should be getting. So the basic rule, we'll just lay the basic rule out, and then we'll have to go into much more detail next time, so that if I sell you something, and either I charge you too much, or you pay too little, that's a violation of the prohibition of onah. And a significant marker, although we'll go into the details, is there's a 1/6 differential. That if you are paying more than 1/6 what you should be paying, or you are paying me less than 1/6 of what you should be paying, so then that's a differential that becomes especially significant, and that negates the sale. What does that mean if it's less than that differential? That's a more complicated discussion that we'll explain in more detail next week. But we have this basic rule that there is both a prohibition and consequences that are associated with price differentials. And sometimes there are many examples where you'll have one without the other. You'll have a prohibition that doesn't necessarily trigger the consequences, or you could have the consequences triggered without the prohibition. We'll talk about both scenarios. Abraham?
The time limits that the Gemara discusses.
Price limits. Time limits?
Time limits. Like if the only, in certain scenarios, the only comes within this amount of time.
Right.
So that's why nowadays.
So that we have to figure out. So that has to, everything is very variable depending on the kind of markets. We'll have to discuss that a little bit. Brett?
Also, when we go based on established markets, do we take into account, let's say, a temporary natural disaster that would allow for price gouging? Let's say they're working with gas.
Right. That's a very basic question. So God willing, we'll get to that. Also, we'll talk about this next week. Just in terms of defining what we just said, it's sometimes gets confused. We're not really addressing in that sentence how much profit you're allowed to make. You know, theoretically, if every store in town decided that they want to make a 300% profit on something, that might be legitimate. It depends on what kind of item it is, and the price gouging consideration you raised is part of it. It depends on what we're talking about and other factors, and there are other reasons why that might not always be right to do. But that's not what onah is. Onah means that the market rate is, all the other stores charge $100 for this, even though they're all making 500% profit, but they all charge $100, and you charge $150, that's where the onah comes in. Or he pays you $50 instead of $100, that's where the onah comes in. It's not addressing the question of how much profit is legitimate to make. That sometimes gets confused. People think that onah means that you can't make more than 1/6 profit on something. That might be true for other reasons, but the onah is not talking yet about the profit. It's talking about, regardless of how much markup and how much else has been factored in and everything else, now whatever the going rate is, if you deviate from the going rate in one direction or the other, that's where onah comes in. And what Brett was raising is that there could be all kinds of reasons why the market might shift, and where different markets can be perceived differently. So God willing, we'll have to get into those details. So,
aside from onah, are there any other limitations on how much profit a person can make?
That's what I'm saying, that there could be other reasons. The Gemara Bava Basra talks separately about that, that there are certain staples of life, that's where the price gouging conversation comes in, that it might be wrong for other reasons to charge too much profit, but it's a separate concept from onah. Onah is basically about deception. It's basically about, and therefore it's in a sense totally different from price gouging, because price gouging, essentially you're taking advantage of the fact the guy might know that he's paying through the nose, but he has no choice because it's the only thing he can get it. Onah is a little bit the opposite concept, because onah means he could get it for cheaper, he doesn't realize he could get it for cheaper. So he could go down the street and buy it for less than the other store, and he doesn't know that, so you take advantage of him, and either knowingly or unknowingly, we'll talk about that also, but you charge him more than 1/6 what he could be getting down the street, that's where the difference comes in. So in a sense, it's a little bit mutually exclusive to price gouging. It's not taking advantage of the fact that he can't get it anywhere else, which has its own issues, but he actually could, and that's the problem, that he could have gotten it for much less, and you're exploiting his lack of awareness of that and charging him more.
Isn't that better than just like shit in his face? Because
it's two different offenses. That's the thing. They could both be moral problems.
Yeah.
But they're two different moral problems. This one, onah, is based on deception.
One way, both ways, he's missing out on price. One way, though, he's embarrassed. One way he's going, like, you're like, oh, too bad, you have to buy it for me.
Yeah, the embarrassment is a separate component. That also could come up, but that's a separate component. So God willing, we'll address all these issues next week, but it's just those are two separate ideas. Price gouging, you're exploiting the fact that he has no other options. And Onah, he Dafka does have other options. And if he didn't have any other options, it wouldn't be Onah. If this was the only price he could get, then it wouldn't be that. It might be something else. So God willing, we'll fill that in next week. Everyone should have a wonderful week, wonderful Shabbat, the only good things.